I'm Wendy Ring.
And I'm Brian Curtis. Welcome to Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up. Before we jump into today's episode, we've got an update from a previous story.
San Francisco's Board of Supervisors and Transit Authority voted in April 2022 to keep JFK Drive and Golden Gate Park permanently car-free.
Hey, cool. You can find the story of how that happened and what it means for safe biking in San Francisco at cool-solutions.org.
Speaking of biking, I'm planning a bike trip around the Great Lakes, and while figuring out how to get myself, my husband, and our e-bikes from Northern California to our starting point in Michigan, I discovered that traveling with an e-bike, as opposed to traveling on one, is harder than traveling with a regular bicycle. They can't go on airplanes, and while they can go on Amtrak, if part of your route is on an Amtrak bus, as ours is, that's up to the bus driver's discretion. Thinking maybe we could drive our Chevy Bolt, I pulled up an app to check out fast EV charging stations along our route. And it's a good thing I did, because we might have found ourselves stranded in the great charging desert that is most of Montana, Wyoming, North and South Dakota, and Northern Minnesota. We'd have to detour into Colorado to avoid running out of juice. Perhaps not surprisingly, many of the states where fast chargers are thin on the ground are coal states. There are zero in West Virginia. But going back to that big charging desert stretching from Montana to northern Minnesota, one thing that stands out on the map of that part of the country are all the reservations. Blackfeet, Crow, Northern Cheyenne, Standing Rock, Crow Creek, Rosebud, Pine Ridge, Spirit Lake, Red Lake, and more. We're about to meet some folks who'll be putting some of those places on the charging map.
My Lakota name is Wonbo. My colonial name is Joseph McNeil, Jr.
Joseph is the general manager of the Standing Rock Renewable Energy Power Authority, or SAGE.
My name is Robert Blake. I am the executive director of Native Sun Community Power Development and tribal citizen of the Red Lake Nation.
Native Sun and SAGE recently got a $6.7 million grant to build the Upper Midwest Intertribal EV Charging Network that will connect tribal communities in Minnesota and North and South Dakota with each other and with urban centers like Minneapolis, Duluth, Bismarck, and Rapid City.
We're going through Red Lake. We're going through White Earth. We're coming through Standing Rock, bringing it back through Rosebud, Lower Sioux.
The grant will fund 120 public chargers that will be located along these routes and in Native communities. Roughly half will be level 2 chargers that can add 20 to 30 miles of range in an hour. And half will be rapid direct current chargers that can add 200 miles in 20 to 30 minutes.
The grant will also fund the purchase of 19 electric vehicles.
We have school buses, we've got work trucks, we've got Teslas that would be going to the tribes themselves.
Standing Rock Transportation is our local transit authority, and they run all around the reservation. They'll transport anyone. Basically, you call and we'll come get you. So one of the vehicles will be going there. Both casinos will be acquiring one. Here at SAGE, we'll be acquiring a truck and a pull-behind solar trailer to take to all the Wachipis, to the powwows, to do renewable energy demonstrations so that people can understand what an electric vehicle is, get in it, you know, ride it. For us here at home to have exposure to this technology and an ability to charge a vehicle, not in the border towns, not just in everybody else's world. Our kids will know that.
When the federal government extended the electrical grid to rural America back in the 1930s, many tribes were not included. Today, 14% of homes on reservations are without electricity, compared with 1.4% of American households nationwide.
With this new intertribal charging network, Bob and Joseph are determined that this time, instead of being left behind, tribes will lead the way.
For now, with the exception of those 19 tribal electric vehicles, most of the people using the charging stations will be city dwellers who are passing through. Rural areas are lagging behind in electric vehicle adoption, with new EV registration rates of 0 to 1.5%. That equates to fewer than 5, and in many cases, 0 registered EVs per 10,000 people, while registered EVs in metro counties range from 10 to more than 100. So what's the problem? You think you know, don't you?
Despite Republican politicians bashing EVs, The reasons are not ideological.
A recent national poll showed a large bipartisan majority of American voters support policies like EV tax credits, public fleet electrification, and deployment of charging infrastructure that would accelerate the rate of electric vehicle adoption. And we know that conservatives do buy them.
A recent survey of Tesla buyers showed that there are almost as many Republicans as Democrats.
So if it's not identity politics, what's the holdup? We asked a guy who's working on this problem. Matt Fitzgibbon is the manager of beneficial electrification at Tri-State Generation and Transmission Association. Tri-State provides power to rural electric cooperatives and public utilities for a 250,000 square mile swath of the rural West.
We are made up of 42 cooperatives and public power districts across four states: Colorado, Nebraska, Wyoming, and New Mexico. The members own the co-ops. So at the end of the line, those consumers actually own Tri-State as well.
Matt's job is helping member co-ops promote everything from electric barbecue grills to heat pump hot water heaters and electric vehicles.
I love the work that I'm doing. I think that it is vitally important to ensure that rural communities are included in this clean energy transition and are able to have the same advantages that their counterparts in the metro area do. Everybody should have equitable access.
Full disclosure, Tri-State is one of those rural cooperatives which has been slow to abandon their coal-burning power plants. Torn between members and state governments who staunchly support coal and those with ambitious targets for 100% clean energy, they've committed to close coal plants in some states, but not others. But even electric vehicles powered by coal emit less greenhouse gases than vehicles burning gasoline and diesel.
Back to the question of why rural folk are slow to adopt EVs. Matt says one of the biggest barriers is availability.
You go out to the car dealerships in these areas and they do not have EVs on the lot. They're not talking about them. They're not looking to sell them right now. And there's various reasons for that, like not having the expertise on staff to repair them, not having the equipment. But when you don't have that option for somebody to come in and look at when they're purchasing their car, that's definitely going to create a lower rate of acceptance.
I've heard stories of local car dealers trying to talk people out of buying an EV. Half of a dealership's profits come from parts and services, and since EVs don't have as many moving parts, they don't need as frequent service or repairs. In small towns with a couple dealers, there's not many alternatives, and two-thirds of states, including those with large rural populations, have protectionist laws that prohibit direct sales by car manufacturers. With so many new companies making electric vehicles, that's something that's got to change.
Tri-State has developed another way to familiarize rural residents with electric vehicles. They bought a small fleet of their own so that member cooperatives can do ride-in drives.
I wonder if that name is a play on ride and tie.
Ride and what?
A ride and tie is a long-distance relay race where each team has two people and one horse. One person sets off riding and the other starts out running. The rider gets to a trade-off point, ties up the horse, and takes off by ankle express. When the first rider reaches the horse, they get on and ride till they meet their partner, and then they switch, etc. There used to be a hippie version of here where everyone took a shot of rye at the starting line and we raced to the beach. But for a rural area, an event that sounds like ride and tie could be a good marketing thing. On the other hand, it could backfire. I mean, who'd want to get in the car if you thought you'd have to get out and run? Yeah, we'll meet up 15 miles down the road, and then you can have another chance behind the wheel.
Matt says a ride and drive is nothing like a Ryan Tide. Here's how he describes one he took part in New Mexico.
You have three or four people that get in the car. We had a planned route, and we knew where we were going to stop and swap drivers. And so everybody got to experience this, and the cool part is you have that camaraderie of everybody that's experienced this for the first time, or maybe it's the second or third time. But when you get behind the wheel and you are familiar driving your own vehicle, so for me, I have a pickup truck, and that's what I'm familiar with, and that's what I like to drive. And you get in this car, and you're hitting that pedal, and it's just taking off. There's a thrill to it, you know, in moderation, right? You have to figure out how these cars operate, and meanwhile, you have the folks that you're in the car with that are really excited to be there, and everybody's talking about the same thing, about how they might apply this to their daily lives. And you start to think about your own scenarios and what you might be able to do and achieve with an electric vehicle. You get all this excitement built up and you get that experience of something that hasn't been around that long. a lot of people haven't had that opportunity yet in our rural communities.
Ride and Drive brings the vehicles and the opportunity to them.
We currently have a Tesla Model 3, a Model Y, a Chevy Bolt, and a Pacifica plug-in hybrid. And these vehicles are okay, but they don't necessarily meet the needs of our rural communities. You see a lot of pickup trucks in these communities. And so we hear a lot of the excitement behind the upcoming Ford Lightning and the new GMC and Chevy Silverado that are going to be all electric. I think that's going to present a huge opportunity for folks that want to go electric, but the vehicle types weren't meeting their needs. So far, we've had 25 of our 42 members participate. We've done over 100,000 miles of driving, and we've had well over 7,000 drivers. A lot of different folks are coming, a pretty good cross-section of the communities that we're in. You have those that are extremely interested in the environmental aspects. You have those that are primary adopters of technological change. You have those that are skeptics that want to come and maybe debate the merits or the abilities of an EV. But these are all good conversations to have.
And it works.
It's been wildly successful. This is one of the most exciting things about my career so far is seeing the response that we get. People get in these cars. We have this theory, right? It's once you drive it, you're going to want to buy it. And it's true. We have had maybe one or two negative responses to a driving experience. Most folks are walking away thinking, man, this is really awesome. This is like driving a race car. It's got that instantaneous throttle. This is really cool. Now, whether it fits into their daily life or not, that's going to be up to them to determine. But I can say we've had some folks go out and purchase an electric vehicle the following week.
Adding EVs to tribal fleets will serve some of the same purpose as the ride and drive, but lack of exposure is just one of the barriers to rural EV adoption.
Here's another big one. There's more range anxiety out on the range.
Range anxiety is definitely one of the biggest barriers to electric vehicle adoption in rural areas. There are a lot of what I refer to as 1% use cases that we have to consider when we live in a rural community, like getting to the airport or getting to a doctor's appointment that might be the next town over. These things take a lot of range, and you have to be concerned about being able to find open charging that is functional at the time to get to where you need to be. On top of that, you start thinking about the time aspect of charging. How long it might take, and do you really have an additional 30 to 45 minutes to charge your battery to the capacity that's necessary? These are things that are going to evolve over time and become less and less of a barrier. But right now, we have to look at where the charging is located, and is there enough charging between points for you to get from point A to point B? About 90% of charging occurs at home, but in the rural territories, you're driving further. And there is some significant concern about being able to get there and get back if you don't have a public charger available. So the lack of infrastructure, necessary or not, creates a barrier to adoption.
Points A and B are further apart in rural areas. Matt says Tri-State's members report driving 60 to 100 miles per day compared with the urban average of 40 miles per day. And if you have to do that driving in a place where it gets real cold, there's even more reason to be anxious. Testing by Consumer Reports and AAA showed that driving in 20-degree weather with the heater running cuts EV range by 40%. Those longer distances driven by rural residents explain why an EV saves them twice as much and cuts double the greenhouse gas emissions compared with urban EV drivers. Electricity is a lot cheaper than gas, and the prices are less volatile. In a recent analysis comparing a Ford F-150, a Toyota RAV4 SUV, and a Honda Civic with their electrical counterparts, the cost per mile was 3 to 5 times higher for the gas vehicles. In North Dakota, filling a car with electricity costs the equivalent of 85 cents a gallon. That kind of affordable mobility would make a huge difference for people in Standing Rock.
We're roughly 30 miles to 40 miles away from any large store or large grocery store. We do have 2 grocery stores here, but everything's trucked in, so the prices are much higher. For our community, with 45% poverty rate and 75% unemployment. So we've had intergenerational poverty and that trauma. And so it's important for us to have access to this.
You're listening to Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up. We're talking with Bob Blake from Native Sun and Joseph McNeil from the Standing Rock Sioux Sage Development Authority about their Upper Midwest Intertribal EV Charging Network and overcoming barriers to rural electric vehicle adoption. Sure, new EVs are pricey now, but as battery prices drop, more used cars enter the marketplace, and incentives are tailored to increase equity, these savings will be available to the people who need them the most.
That's all great for electric vehicle drivers, but for the hosts and owners of rural fast charging stations, things may not pencil out so nicely.
That's because of something called a demand charge. This is a little bit nerdy, but it's important, so we're going there. We don't pay demand charge as residential customers, but commercial customers and owners of EV charging stations do. You can think of it like the difference between an odometer that tells you how far you've gone and a speedometer that tells you how fast. The odometer is the price we all pay based on the number of kilowatts we use. The speedometer, which would be the demand charge, is an added charge that's based on the amount of peak power you draw. It's money to support the utility's ability to provide peak power when we need it. Rapid EV charging takes a lot of power. I've read in different places that charging one new car pulls as much power off the grid as 50 or 300 U.S. homes. I tried to nail down which number was right and wasn't able to, but you get the idea. It's a lot. And it doesn't all come out smoothly like when you fill up your gas tank.
While gasoline flows in at a steady rate, electricity flows in quickly at the beginning and very slowly towards the end.
It's like the opposite of a ketchup bottle. Instead of shake, 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 glug, the big glug comes first.
That first fast bit is where the demand charge comes in, and it can be quite expensive. Otter Tail Power, that serves the Red Lake Nation, charges about 4 cents per kilowatt for the electricity, but $4 per kilowatt for the demand.
If the charger's used a lot, user fees and sales to people who shop while they're charging can make up for that demand charge.
But if it isn't used a lot?
That's a problem. The National Association of State Energy Officials did some modeling and found it takes at least 10 charges a day for a station to just break even. If only one car a week charged at a station, each charging session could cost the host as much as $770. That's extreme, but not totally far-fetched when North Dakota only has 266 registered electric vehicles in the entire state. And most people charge their EVs at home. So it's a chicken and egg problem. We need more fast charging stations to get more people to buy electric vehicles, but until there are enough electric vehicles in rural areas, those charging stations can't break even, unless we get utilities to drop the demand charge.
The Intertribal Charging Network's federal grant is picking up the power costs for the first 3 years, but it's not clear what happens after that.
One possible future solution that's in the pilot phase is pairing fast EV chargers with battery storage. A boost from the battery doesn't incur a demand charge, and storing up energy from the sun during the day means less dirty and expensive peaker plant use at night.
The network's EV charge stations will also give a boost to the local economy.
When we first started this project, the idea was to create an electric vehicle charging network pipeline in response to the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline and the Dakota Access Pipeline. We looked at this as another form of resistance. The fight's not over with. We're going to defeat the fossil fuel industry one way or another. This is going to be just another way we're going to do it. Then we started realizing that through this pandemic, rural economies were really hurting bad.
Both tribes are heavily reliant on their casinos, but COVID exposed a vulnerability.
People that had the most disposable income, retirees, weren't going to the casino. Tribal nations were teetering on bankruptcy. And so it dawned on me that this is going to be like a Route 66.
If your business has a charger, it's like a tractor beam pulling relatively wealthy electric vehicle owners off the road and into your establishment.
People are going to be able to travel this route and spend some money in these rural areas and really show them how the electrification of our transportation system can be a win-win for everyone.
The Intertribal EV Charging Network is part of a broad strategy to end the use of fossil fuels. Bob and Joseph would like to see their EV chargers powered with clean energy. But more than half of the electricity provided on both reservations comes from coal.
I believe tribal nations can push these utilities, which are like dinosaurs. They're dinosaurs, and they have so much clout pushing their agenda. They have 80-year coal contracts that they got to sell us. And these guys aren't going to move for us. So we have to move them. And this is where I say tribal nations play a big role, because we are the only people inside of this government with our own government.
Tribal lands compose approximately 2% of the U.S. land area, but hold 5% of the country's renewable energy resources, with the potential to generate an estimated 14 billion megawatts from solar alone. The Red Lake Nation already has solar panels installed on several tribal buildings and hopes to build a solar farm that could power its EV chargers. Sage is developing a 235-megawatt wind farm that will sell power off the reservation.
Our intention is to use the revenue to build systems at home for our communities, microgrids. That has a direct relationship to our people's ability to pay for electric costs, drive those costs down by a home system that's owned by the tribe. Our job is to create these systems for our people here at home so that we're not creating pollution, so that we are self-reliant, so that we're resilient. That's the real goal. We're currently writing in for grants to do feasibility studies for all of our communities, district buildings, and then we got one community to do a microgrid with.
These local projects are hampered by North Dakota policies that exempt rural electric cooperatives from net metering and allow utilities to pay only a small fraction of the retail rate.
Net metering is what provides the mechanism for most other states to do the large projects and get a large return for their power that they're generating.
The tribe intends to negotiate with a cooperative for a better deal.
As a tribal community, we think that we have an exclusivity right to provide for our people. If we can't do that for ourselves as a sovereign Eden, what good is the treaty?
They're also advancing a new paradigm with their wind project.
Developers that we've been talking to, they're all very interested in the project, but they're all very interested in just doing a land lease. And we expressed to them, that's great for you, but we're looking at a level of ownership throughout the project life, and that increasing after the investors have paid off.
That ownership stake is important to make sure energy development remains consistent with tribal values.
Our project is really focused around protecting sacred sites, and we moved 23 of our turbines. Very important that we protect those, because those are spiritual points, connecting points for people who might have a dream. My kid or my grandkid might have a dream, or somebody might feel a pull to a location. And those spiritual connecting points from our ancestors to the earth, Uchimaka, to the Star Nation, where our ancestors are, all this interconnectedness we intend to protect, not just for ourselves, but so all of our relatives, that being those that fly, those that crawl, those that swim, etc., live in harmony and in respect with one another, so that our kids can have a world that shares the same thing. If you don't have a connection to the earth, to the land, then you're not a people. And as a people, we've survived. You've survived. Your ancestors brought you to where you are. Us the same. And we've survived the Holocaust. We've survived the genocide. We've survived termination, extermination, relocation, re-education, colonization, you name it, right? We're still here. And we still have our spiritual connection. And for us, it's very important to emphasize that as a central focus of what the work is we're doing. Because if we're not protecting eagles that live in the area, then what are we doing it for? We can't do it just for the dollar, because then we're purely colonized. And that's not something that we want to promote. Our THPO guy, John Eagle, says, he says, Joel, there's a butterfly that can shut this project down. And I said, and if that's the case, then so be it.
The project will use IdentiFlight, a system that detects approaching birds and slows or stops the turbines to prevent injury.
IdentiFlight is constantly on the lookout for eagles or bats, which is very important in the evening, and geese that are flying through, so that we protect our relatives. This is going to have a very beneficial effect on our ability to protect our endangered species, but our relatives moreover.
The charging network and clean energy projects include provisions to develop good jobs for tribal members.
Our goal here is to get our folks trained in to do the service, the wind technicians, the electrical engineering. That's one of the important parts of SAGE as a public power authority, is that we would have that negotiation with the developer to have that level of training so that SAGE in 10 years becomes the O&M provider of our own wind farm.
We've got to put a lot of effort into workforce development. We got to replace transmission lines. We got to create linemen. And those are good jobs. When you look at a solar project, you see like 5 to 10 guys that are putting it together, but you don't realize that there were like 20 other support positions that made that job possible. These are very technical jobs. You're really going to have to use your analytical skills. I believe that more people using their analytical skills, that's going to have a ripple effect in the community. My hope is that I'll start to see the disparities that are plaguing this community fall to the wayside, like suicide, like drug addiction, like missing murdered Indigenous women. All these things that are plaguing this community, I hope to see fall to the wayside because we've got purpose and there is healing in the environment. I helped put together a solar training program for inmates at the Willow River Correctional Facility in northern Minnesota. The idea there was to fight mass incarceration. One of the guys that we had go through the solar training program through Willow River, he's got his family, he's getting married, he's got his kids. You know, he says it, solar changed his life. If I do that one person right there, then I did my job as a human being, you know. I really do believe this.
At a time when many of us are disappointed and disillusioned to find our government and world leaders falling short on addressing the climate emergency, both men say we all have the power to act. Don't look up, look within.
Follow your passion, follow your heart, and it will lead you in the right direction, just like this has led me into this work that I am so grateful to be a part of now.
You have to be brave and put yourself in these positions and even push against the will of your own people, your own community sometime, and just keep doing the work, because if you see something real and you know it's going to benefit your kids, then do it, because we need everyone to get involved. We need everyone to make a difference in their communities and say, we don't want this extractive life anymore. We live in one of the greatest times in mankind. So many things that are happening, so many things that are pivotal. And when we leave this earth, we need to know that we've done something positive. You know, not just for humankind, but for all of our relatives.
I'm Brian Curtis.
And I'm Wendy Ring. Thanks for listening to Cool Solutions. You can find more stories about climate action from the bottom up wherever you get your podcasts and at our website, cool-solutions.org. Thanks to Robert Blake, Joseph McNeil, and Matt Fitzgibbon for sharing their stories, and to Josh Woodward, Kevin McLeod, Scott Holmes, and the Old Town School of Folk Music for our music.